Welcome back to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For many Muslim communities, particular religious identities were formulated or hardened within colonial realities. These types of cultural encounters were structural for the various Muslim tribes in the southern Philippine islands of Mindanao and Sulu during the turn of the 20th century. In Making Moros, Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippines Muslim South, published with Northern Illinois University Press in 2012, Michael Hawkins demonstrates the dramatic consequences of this short historical moment for Filipino Muslims. Between 1899 and 1913, professional ethnographers and military officers worked to represent Filipino Muslims as noble primitive warriors. Various communal identities were fused into a singular construction, the Moro. Moro identity was constructed in the American imagination to serve colonial civilizing agendas. Ultimately, this period served as a crucial moment for Filipino Muslim identity and is looked back upon with nostalgia. In our conversation, we discussed imperial historicism, colonial legitimacy, taxonomy and classification, capitalism, slavery in American Moro society, communal remembrance, frontiers, and Islamic authenticity. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Michael Hawkins. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Welcome back to New Books in Islamic Studies. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Michael Hawkins about his great new book, Making Moros, Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in Philippines Muslim South. Thanks for joining me, Mike. How you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was really a pleasure to read your book. You've really done a great job here and exploring a really interesting history, which I think not a lot of people are knowledgeable of, and you do it in a very clear and concise way. So thank you for writing this great book.
Oh, thank you so much.
As is tradition with the New Books interviews, before we delve into the content and some of the things you're exploring, I was hoping you could give us a little bit of a background on your training, people that might have been influential either in the topics you explore or your approaches, and specifically what brought you to the subjects you work on today.
Great. Yeah, sure. It was kind of funny. Mindanao had always seemed to be the apparent choice, just one I couldn't see for some reason. I had been really fortunate when I was younger to live in the Philippines for several years and learned the languages and just kind of became part of it. And so when I got back, in my master's program, in the early part of my PhD program, I'd been much more interested in religious movements in Luzon and nationalist movements in the post-colonial era and these kinds of things. And I had always known of Mindanao. I mean, I'd been there a couple times. My wife is from a very Christian area of northern Mindanao. But Mindanao had always been this sort of foreboding place in the Philippines. Up north, they're very cautious and always warning, you know, don't go there. It's very dangerous. It's trouble, there's wars and difficulties and what have you. And I had always had a mild interest. And when I was a PhD student, I had the really wonderful opportunity to work with a grant program at Northern Illinois University with Dr. Sue Russell and Dr. Lena Ong. And it was a program that brought together youth from the Philippines that were Christian Lumad, which are Highland animists, and Muslims or Moros. And they brought these youth together and would facilitate interethnic dialogue and peace studies. And we had the opportunity to host them at various times. And it had such an impact on the ways that I was thinking about the Philippines and the way I was thinking about colonialism and post-coloniality, the way I thought about concepts of national authenticity is configured and sort of articulated by various ethno-linguistic groups in the Philippines. And through the course of this grant work and with the help of some other friends that I'd gotten to know, it really suddenly became clear, and I began to ask myself, why haven't I been doing Mindanao the entire time? I mean, I have every connection in the world there. My wife is from there, for heaven's sake. This is what I was meant to do. Why didn't I see this? And so as soon as I began to look into the history of the Moros, I was immediately hooked. I was immediately fascinated, and began to dig deeper and deeper into the archival material and into the secondary literature. And by that point, as a lot of academics know, when you find something like that, it almost begins to write itself. I mean, it's just sort of pulling this indefinite research thread. And I really found that to be the case with this project. And it's one that, in some ways, even with the book, has not ended. Yeah, even close.
Hmm. Now, I forget if it's the introduction or somewhere in the beginning, you talk about how much of this work was developed during your dissertation work. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you made the progression from dissertation to book? A lot of listeners are probably also writing books or dissertations. Mm-hmm. So were you thinking of this as kind of a book when you started to, or it started to write itself, or was there kind of specific steps you needed to take to move from the dissertation to the book?
Yeah, it was sort of an emerging project that had its genesis in an article that I wrote. And that's really kind of the one that wrote itself. I had been deeply, deeply influenced by subaltern studies and new imperial history, and was really sort of thinking in these conceptual ways, as grad students are often found to be, you know, deeply mired in their theory. And when I came across these archival materials, when I was a second year graduate student, I published an article with the Journal of Southeast Asian Studies, which was Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippine Muslim South. And this article felt so right. It just felt like this is something that has an enormous amount of potential. And so with that article as a basis, I wrote a Fulbright proposal that proposed to go and really expound on these ideas about imperial historicism and American military rule. And so during the Fulbright, I was able to spend quite a few months in the archives in Manila and quite a few months down in Mindanao, and within the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao and various places. And so when I got back, I was just simply buried in materials that I had found. And I put it together into the dissertation, and the dissertation went fairly well. I mean, it wouldn't be true to say it simply wrote itself. Dissertations are always more painful than that. And so I put it together, and I did, when I put it together, I really thought, this is something that I want and that needs to be turned into a book at some point. And so after the dissertation defense, I went to work expanding various places. And one of the problems with the dissertation, and this is a problem I think a lot of doctoral students find as well, is that it was really opaque in places and deeply, deeply sort of mired in these abstract theoretical discussions of empire and of historicism and these kinds of things. And I think in some ways, if I were to be honest, I think the book it can be dense in places still. But one of the efforts was to try to get rid of some of that, try to replace it with a bit more of the narrative history, to try to expound it in various archival ways. I added a little bit of biographical information for some of the key players, both on the American side and I think to a lesser extent on the Moro side. And so really the project of turning it into a book was taking it from this, at the time of the dissertation, what I thought would be this really highly theoretical contribution to historiography and theories of empire, and turning it into something that actually had more to say about history and flesh it out in a way that would be appealing, I think, to a larger audience than maybe 20 or 25 people around the world. So, yeah, it was really a matter. So I went to College Park and did some research. I went to Ann Arbor and did some research to get a few more things that it needed, and really tried to sacrifice some things that were hard to get rid of, but then fill it up with things that I think maybe rounded the book out a little bit better.
Yeah, I think overall it's a really great contribution, both from the theoretical perspective and the narrative historical details you give us. So I think you've striked a good balance.
Well, thank you.
Perhaps we could set the stage a little bit before we delve into some of these really interesting things you're setting up here. Could you give us some of the narrative background that, that might be important for listeners to know before we get into these explorations, such as, you know, what do the southern Philippine islands look like socially, politically, etc., in the mid to late 19th century? When does America enter the picture? What effects does that have?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the Philippines, of course, is this incredibly heterogeneous archipelago composed of 7,100 islands with numerous ethno-linguistic groups, multiplicity of religious tradition. And so it's this very heterogeneous place. The Spanish had tried to congeal these islands into a recognizable colony, but there were really two groups that the Spanish were never able to conquer, and that were that was the Highland Animists in Luzon, the Igorots, and of course the Moros down south. And this creates a little bit of a divergence in national development in the Philippines. Whereas most of the lowland Filipinos in Luzon and the Visayas were Christianized, and increasingly their orientation became more and more Western. And it's often said, and I think truthfully, that the Philippines is the most Westernized of all of the countries of Southeast Asia. And so their orientation was more and more focused on the West, focused on Europe, focused on Christianity and traditions that spring therefrom. Whereas the Moros very much still oriented themselves to the east and to the south, out into what we call James Warren calls the Suluzong. And so when the Americans arrive in 1898, we really have this divergent group of people in the Philippines. And the Americans were determined to cobble it all together. Nevertheless, they realized that this would be a problem with these divergent trajectories that had been taken. And so what they decided to do was to formally colonize the Philippines. And after the Philippine-American War was somewhat sorted out, they decided that they would continue to rule what they called the uncivilized or the savage tribes with the military while implementing in small measure civilian government throughout the rest of the islands. And so the Moros were under military government from 1899 to 1914. And the United States really felt that this was the best way to deal with these less civilized peoples. But this presents kind of an interesting alternative to the general narrative of American colonialism in the Philippines. Because they were ruled by the U.S. military, it was much more of an autonomous colony, a much more autocratic colony. In essence, the American military could sort of dictate and reprimand or remand policy at their discretion. They could really create the colony that they wanted to create. And in some ways, this allowed American imperialists to experiment in eccentric ways, to try things that weren't available elsewhere in the islands. And so Moro Province really becomes this sort of crucible for colonial experimentation. And the American military was, despite the fact that we typically associate the American military with sort of more conservative colonial policies, they were very much progressives. I mean, they're very excited to hasten this evolutionary process and to make a modern sort of bourgeois man out of these Moros. And they implement various policies to try to make that happen. And so that's really the subject matter of the book, is it looks at those 14 years of American military rule and the various ways that the military is really conducting an almost separate colonial experiment in Moro Province than the rest of the United States in the islands at large.
Yeah. Another thing that you discuss in the book, which listeners might not be aware of, is even among the Muslim population at the time, there was a great diversity. Can you give us a little background on the different groups of Muslims that were there?
Yeah, absolutely. They're just as in the rest of the islands, the ethno-linguistic groups are really staggering when you consider their breadth and depth across the places. And so Mindanao was no different. Despite the fact that they all proclaimed an adherence to Islam, there were a variety of ethno-linguistic groups. And the Americans, as they began to get to know some of these Moro groups, some of these ethno-linguistic groups, they really, in a very classic sort of Orientalist fashion, characterized various traits and did ethnological studies that would determine what kind of policies. And so the Lanao Moros, for example, the Maranao were viewed as very industrious, but also somewhat volatile and potentially violent. There were hot spots where they had the Insulu, the Taosug, for example, could be somewhat violent. Holo, these kinds of things. And so they really crafted their policies to conform with whatever ethnological views they'd created of these various ethno-linguistic groups, even among the Moros. And so we do get this little bit of tension where the Americans are tempted at times to really characterize Moro province as the Muslim province, but at the same time, they have to take into account the variety of ethno-linguistic groups that are operating and often in alliance or in antagonism or antagonistic relationships with one another. And so it really is kind of a trick of their rule to try to sort this out, to crystallize it in a way that conforms with American policymaking methods.
Hmm. Now, one of the key things you're trying to do here is give the Moros a voice, I guess. You explicitly say you're not writing an American history in the Philippines. You're not writing a nationalist history of the Philippines. And you're really taking up this subaltern voice and trying to let it speak for itself. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your sources, because these sources seem hard to get. And you talk specifically about the idea of the archive. And so perhaps are there Moro sources that we can access, or how did you go about doing that kind of things? And then the more I guess, Western accessible sources, perhaps how do you read those against the grain in order to access the Moros voice?
Right. Yeah. So this is really the biggest challenge of the book. And you're absolutely right. I am, by training and in practice, a Southeast Asianist. That's all I do. So I am not a historian of American empire. I'm not an Americanist by any means. I am a Southeast Asianist. And so for me, it was important to cast the book in that way, that this is Philippine history. So the book was meant to be Philippine history that is simply occurring during the time of American colonial occupation. And by doing so, I really tried to craft it in a way that the historiography would be centered in telling this story of the Philippines and not a constituent part of the American empire. So that was one of the first things that I did. To the subaltern voice, this is really the challenge. And it's been some legitimate criticism of the book. It says, well, where do we get these Moro voices? And the simple fact is, at least to my knowledge, by and large, they don't exist in a pure, unadulterated form, the way that, you know, Ulysses S. Grant's diaries exist. Now, occasionally we get actual Moro words and we get Moro voices, but they're really sparse and few and far between. And so my method in sort of coercing these voices out was really twofold. The first of which is I tried to bookend the study a little bit and let the study at least be informed by a little bit of participant observation research in the Philippines. So to go to Moro province, to go to Marawi, to go speak with individuals and simply ask, you know, what were your perceptions of the American colonial period? How is that remembered in popular memory? What does it mean? And so in the introduction and then in the epilogue, I discuss quite a bit some of the early guidance that I received from key figures in Moro province, where they sort of indicated this nostalgia in some sense for the American military period, which was a much more hands-off, a less social engineering, a sort of episode in which Moros were made in modernity, in which they participated. They were various points in the book, and we'll talk about it later, but the Moros are really cast as these supermen, right? These wonderful specimens of primal man, unadulterated. And the Moros love that, and they participated in that. And so I, at least to sort of contextualize it, I went right to the source as it exists today, and it was incredibly helpful. The second way that I tried to coerce it out is what I think a lot of historians like myself have to do, and that is you have to go back to the colonial sources, which are indeed 99% of the time produced by the colonial power, And you have to really engage in some rigorous discourse analysis. We have to try to read between the lines and sort of tease out the ways in which the subaltern is participating, collaborating, resisting, reappropriating, redefining. And a lot of this we have to do deductively. We have to look at what the Americans are attempting and why they think this doesn't work or why they think it does work and how they correct their policies and how they adapt their policies and these kinds of things. And so from that, we can sort of deduce and piece together what the responses must have been from the subaltern. And I think in a lot of ways, once this practice gets going, it's really quite revealing that by looking at the way that the Americans are able to change their policies, to change their discourse, to adapt what they're doing, it really kind of paints a very, very clear picture of what the Moros are doing on the other side, either collaboratively or how they're resisting. Now, the hard part, and admittedly the difficult part about this, is it is not empirical gold. Right, it's not the kind of thing you can look at and say, "Yeah, that's incredibly explicit, and it is incredibly apparent, and this is something that we can just put on the paper and kind of let it speak for itself." That's just not the way that it can be done. At least in my experience, it takes quite a bit of work on the part of the historian to piece together this story by looking at, in essence, its consequences in official discourse, right? Or the adaptations that are shown. And it's challenging at times. It's incredibly rewarding at times. But I think in some ways, if it's not done this way, then we lose something. We do lose this subaltern voice. We lose this examination of what lurks in the shadows and what lurks just beyond the discourse and what's influencing the colony as it's reported and portrayed in the official documents. And I think that more and more, this is what we're going to see. I mean, more and more, this is what we are seeing, I think, is that historical actors, they have something to say, and what they have to say is often through the reactions of others. And it's a little bit of a deductive game, but I think in the end can be rewarding.
Yeah, there are definitely some really beautiful scenes you've set, and I think a lot of it does come through or rise above those kind of more official imperial discourses. So you've done a very good job in my reading.
Well, thank you.
One of the kind of underlying theoretical structures you're using in this book is this idea of imperial historicism, which we could maybe interpret as an ideological guide for structuring attitudes and rationales and actions. How does imperial historicism function in your book? How did colonial discourses shape Muslim interpretations of their own modernity?
Good. Yeah. So this is what I envisioned as being the major theoretical contribution of the book. And as I said at the beginning, I was really deeply influenced by this new imperial history movement that began in the late 90s and has carried on, you know, until now. And was deeply influenced by the thinking of Stoller and Cooper and their book Tensions of Empire and Bernard Cohn and Dipesh Chakrabarty and Subaltern School and these kinds of things. And so I was really sort of intrigued by the ways that discourse is neither inherent nor stable. And I really bought deeply into this idea that colonialism was not hegemonic by any means, and that it was a constant negotiation. It was malleable, and it was unstable. And so I felt that in reading a lot of colonial histories of the Philippines, race as a category of analysis was in some ways a default position, that when any colonial policy was examined and the actions of the Americans and these kinds of things, it was very easy to say, okay, well, these are formations of race, or these are articulations of race, these are evolutions of American racial discourse after the Civil War, these are embodiments of American racial thinking, these kinds of things. But I was never fully satisfied by that, because I always felt that the concept of race and race making was, well, as I said, inherently unstable. It was inherently empty and inherently being remade all the time. And I think being informed repeatedly by what was occurring in the colonies. And I was a big fan, and still am a big fan, of Paul Kramer's book, Blood of Government, where he talks about the policies and methods of race making in the Philippines. And his book was deeply influential in the sense that it really caused me to think about what is at the heart of American imperial ideology. What is really making this happen? And the more I thought about it, the more I read about it, I found in my own personal research, and not only in this book, but in other pieces I've published, that race plays a part, but race seems to be this ancillary discourse to a more deep-seated notion of evolutionary disparity. That in a very real way, the Americans found themselves at a different place in time. And this different place in time allowed them to look at the Filipinos, and not just them, but, you know, people all over the world, with a sort of omniscience where they could deduce their place in evolutionary time, and by so doing could successfully assess them, prognosticate their future, give a comprehensive rendering of their past. And as I dug deeper and deeper into this, I found that this is everywhere. Everything I was reading, I found this everywhere, these constant allusions to time and these constant sort of discourses that allowed them to omnisciently deduce and to examine their colonial subjects. And as I got deeper into this, I thought to myself, you know what, this actually represents maybe a small amendment to new imperial history, because the work that really comes out after Stoller and Cooper's landmark study is that imperial discourse is in some ways non-existent. And if it is existent, it's chaotic and it's constantly changing and it's unstable, because whatever was conceived in the metropole was negotiated there in and of itself, and it changed when they got on the boat, and it changed as they crossed the Pacific, and it changed in each and every interaction in the periphery or in the colony, because everything was a negotiation. But I find that this notion of imperial historicism was something that is conceived in the metropole and shows remarkable continuity as it crosses the ocean, as it gets into the colony. And what I try to demonstrate in the book is, no matter what disrupture occurs, no matter what problem that they find, either ideologically or practically in the application of policy, these disruptures are more times than not medicated with this discourse of asymmetry of temporal existence, that it can all be explained away in terms of a relative evolutionary lag. And to me, this was a revolution. This was really interesting, where I thought, no, I think I have isolated an imperial discourse that is not subject to the same kinds of radical remakings, right, to the inherent instability that we see when we get to discourses of race and these other things. And so in the book, what I try to demonstrate is that no matter what the Americans encounter, imperial historicism is informing their ideas and their actions at virtually every encounter. Mm. And to me, I thought it was really kind of exciting to see something when historians look across a vast array of sources and they can see something that occurs again and again and again and again that maybe hasn't received a tremendous amount of study. I get excited about that. So that's really what I was hoping would be the major theoretical contribution of the book.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for kind of taking the time to flesh that out, because I think that was, from my reading, one of the key things that I think listeners will definitely benefit from. And I hope they do explore your book for this reason. Now, in the first chapter, you are looking at constructions of identity, and specifically How were Filipino Muslims constructed in the American imagination, and what types of processes helped create this image?
Yeah, so the Americans were very excited when they got to Mindanao because they felt that they had these now, the Muslims weren't necessarily a clean slate, but they had a primal quality to them that the Americans felt lacked in other places. So they looked at the thorough Christianization and colonization of lowland Filipinos. And in many ways, the Americans sort of lamented the fact that in their eyes, oh, no, the Spanish have sort of ruined these people, right? They've so thoroughly colonized them that they've emasculated them and that they've turned them into these overly parochial devotees of an archaic form of Iberian Catholicism. And, oh, they just sort of lamented the fact that, you know, we just have to – they've been ruined. It's going to be hard to make modern men. Whereas the Moros, the American military at least, was very excited because they felt that here we have – a population that has never been conquered. And even the American military, I don't think they would go so far as to say that they conquered them. They just, you know, they worked out this sort of accommodation, this form of submission, but without conquering them in a fundamental psychological sense. And so they felt this Moro really represents this visceral masculinity, this primal man that is able to act masculine in a way that I think the Americans would say even we can't anymore. You know, we're sort of over civilized now. We're not allowed to be violent, and we're not allowed to be sort of primitive or primal in any ways. We're alienated from the various mechanisms of our own survival. You know, we don't make our own shoes, we don't grow our own food, we don't do any of these things. But these Moros inhabit very much this sort of rugged individual masculine ethic that I think the Americans saw among themselves and the frontiersmen that made the country. And so the military is incredibly excited about this. And so they go about really constructing the Moro first and foremost as this ideal specimen of primitive, primal, masculine man. So he has all of the requisite building materials to make the ideal modern man. He just needs to be, you know, rounded out and civilized in certain ways. He needs to be domesticated in a sense. But the military was always cautious not to really promote ideas of a conquered people in any way. There are some discussions with the American military I have in there where they said, look, we really messed up with the Native Americans. We pursued policies that destroyed their culture and destroyed their inherent primal masculinities. And we don't want to repeat those mistakes here. We want to make sure that we preserve that in a certain sense. And they go through all these efforts to do it. But these constructions of the Moro were cultural. They were physical. I talk about in the book some of these reports on the Moros where they're essentially made into these physical supermen where they're saying, oh yeah, they have well-defined calves and muscular bodies, and they run and they swim like fish, and they can climb trees and they fall out of those trees and they're not hurt, and their feet, they can run on anything. And you get the feeling that, oh my gosh, these Moros are – apparently they could drink seawater, right? They're just completely indestructible. And so as you can imagine – in some ways, there's a great incentive for the Moros to collaborate on this project with the Americans coming and telling them how wonderful they are and how masculine they are and how fearless they are to face down American guns. Even at points when the Americans had to apply in their minds, of course, episodes of colonial discipline, the Moros took discipline with a certain masculine stoicism. And so the Americans were very, very inspired by this, and they wanted to keep this discourse of masculinity alive and sort of imbibe in it vicariously and recall nostalgically the days of the American frontier. And so in some ways it was this sort of, you know, episode of, I don't know what we call it, sort of colonial narcissism, right? And it's all about them, of course. But very important, I think, to the psyche of these American military colonists.
Yeah. Another part of this was kind of some of the realities of Moro society that didn't align with these understandings or representations. And one of these, which you would assume is a very important part of their identity, is this idea of their relationship to Islam. Mm-hmm. This kind of complicates this American civilizing project. So could you kind of outline what's going on here, what's at stake, and how is this disrupting American representations of the Moros?
Right. So the Americans really love this idea of the primal Moro, right, the savage Moro. But of course, that wasn't the case. These Moros are incredibly cosmopolitan. They have exposure to most of the Southeast Asian trading world. They are active participants in this in the world of Islam and have frequent contacts with Arabs and with South Asians. And so the problem is that disrupts a little bit of the narrative. And so the Americans really go on this campaign to try to discredit the Moros as Muslims. They really pursue this thin and flaking glaze theory where they try to highlight all of the animistic qualities, all of the religious corruptions of Islam, and they try to show that the Moros really, number one, they don't understand the religion in its reality and how it's practiced, and they don't follow its precepts. And number two, what they do understand of it, they've horribly corrupted by infusing it with a variety of animistic beliefs and these kinds of things. And so there's a huge effort on the part of the Americans to really discredit them as Muslims, to show them as sort of, I don't know if apostate would be the right word, but definitely sort of divergent from the practicing ummah of Muslims around the world.
The other part of Moro society that really kind of threw a wrench in this whole procedure was the role of slavery.
Right. So
could you talk about what the role of slavery was in Moro society and perhaps how ideas about slavery align with American historical realities, which were not exactly attuned to each other? And then how do colonial regimes respond to this?
Right. So they really created a problem for themselves. One of the things that made the Americans most excited about the Moros was the fact that they had slaves. So right at the outset of the acquisition of the Philippines, there are newspapers across the United States that are emblazoned with headlines, a second Emancipation Proclamation to be issued by President McKinley. We're going to engage in the work of the great emancipator. We're going to liberate these slaves. This is sort of, again, this very exciting recapitulation of American history that they're looking at. And they're very excited to be part of a new generation that's going to pursue this. And so they begin to go to Moro Province and find out what exactly is going on. How do we liberate? It's interesting to mention, though, and I should mention, that as excited as these very socially minded early 20th century, for the most part, very New England-ish bourgeois members of the colonial regime, how they were taking pride in their social consciousness and wanting to rid the world of the evil of slavery, there was a certain strain of American society that was oddly and uncomfortably nostalgic for the days of slavery. So we'll talk about this later, but working on is the Moro experience at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair. And one of the most sort of disturbing things I've come across there is that the Moros at the fair had brought their entourage with them, which included servants and clients and these kinds of things that Americans perceived as slavery. And so some of the headlines are very excited where they say, oh, Moros are bringing slaves. And for the first time in a generation, Americans are going to be able to witness a human being in bondage, the way that people used to be in bondage in the United States. And so there was this strange nostalgia combined with a crusading ethic to take this on. But it immediately becomes a problem because when the Americans get there, they realize that they're making a mistake. I mean, in classic sort of Bernard Cohn fashion, American policy in the Philippines was predicated upon the assumption of translation, that everything we see should be able to be translated linguistically, culturally, historically into something that we imminently recognize. And so when the Americans actually get down and start to make these ethnological studies of moral society, they go, well, I don't know what to make of this, right? This is a little bit uncomfortable because what we're perceiving as moral slavery is incredibly more humane than chattel slavery as it was practiced in the American South. I mean, the moral circumstances of servitude were much more predicated upon communal values of patron-clientism, of patronage for those in the community that were loosely related, and in many cases, individuals actively sought out patrons as a way to climb socially within the society. And so the Americans are finding that the slaves aren't mistreated. The slaves have a great deal of social mobility. They have a great deal of economic freedom. This doesn't look anything like our slavery. And it kind of unsettled them because American slavery was so much worse, so much more inhumane compared to the Moros, that after a while, the Americans are really forced to sort of moderate their discourse. And in a very silent way, they're forced to retreat from all of this excitement at the outset, where they begin to, and again, with the theoretical thrust of the book, the Americans have to say, well, this is not this doesn't resemble American practices of pre-Civil War slavery. This is much more of a sort of medieval form of vassalage that's predicated upon allegiance to a chieftain. And as a matter of fact, it's so funny how specific they get. At one point, they look at the servitude and they say, yeah, this really resembles what we might see in England under the Stuarts. We can get that specific with it. And so they have to kind of – they really have to back off of this whole endeavor. But again – the disrupture is medicated by imperial historicism. So the Americans don't have to outright say, you know, oh, we're completely wrong. They just simply have to say, okay, well, we have to locate it in a recognizable history here. And so rather than liberating slaves in the way that, you know, may have been done at various points in American history, we have to construct imperial policies that account for it in much more of a medieval practice of vassalage and these kinds of things. And so it was kind of interesting to watch them contort into these various ways to account for what they're seeing. But I, you know, to be fair to the Americans, one thing about them is they are sort of remarkably candid with themselves and sort of agile in their discourse. They're not ones to kind of just dig in and say, okay, well, this is what we see and this is what it will be, by gosh, from now to the end of time. The Americans, when something is disrupted, they're very candid about it. They're very honest about it. Say, okay, well, this doesn't seem to be the case. And they adapt their discourse and their policies in a way that accounts for it, but in a way that's still, again, eminently recognizable to them within their own cultural and historical traditions. In this case, imperial historicism, just sort of relocating them in a different period in recognizable time.
Now, moving past some of these bumps in the road, for many in the colonial regime, capitalism was a route to modernity. So how was capitalism viewed as a means of civilizing? And I guess from the perspective of American imperialists, how did Moros become modern through new market economies?
Yeah, so this was the panacea. This was going to solve all their problems, because in the end, the Americans really felt that they were there not so much to deduce, you know, it wasn't a project overwhelmingly predicated on deducing what the Moros were or where they came from, but the policy is hasten them into modernity as quickly as possible. And so the American military men looked at the rest of the colony and they said, yes, there's a great deal of effort being put into participatory government, into creating sort of the institutions and structures and mechanisms of a democratic state. But down here in Moro Province, we figured it out. And the key in the minds of the American military was capitalism, right? Market systems. Now, on the one hand, the Americans believed that the Moros were absolutely natural capitalists. They put a great deal of time and effort into examining their economic behaviors, and they found a couple of things, or at least they recorded a couple of things. And that was, number one, that the Moros are absolutely industrious. They're hard workers. They're money-minded. They are if there's an opportunity to earn money through labor, they are more than willing to do it. And they actually sort of jab the rest of the colony in uncomfortable ways, trying to construct the lowland Christian Filipino as being indolent and unindustrious and these kinds of things, which certainly was not true uniformly, and trying to use that as a foil against this industriousness of this frontiersman-like Moro. The second thing that they found is that the Moros are incredibly entrepreneurial, that they're constantly thinking of new ways to form businesses and to access markets, and they're very eager to take on new technologies and new methods, and they're very practical in their approach, and anything that will enhance their productivity, they're more than willing to adopt. And so the Americans felt this is very natural, right? They're already there. They're very much like us, is what the Americans were thinking in the military. And so the Americans felt all we need to do is we need to facilitate this. We need to nurture this as much as possible. And so they came up with a number of policies that they thought would help, the most important of which was the development of Moro markets. And these were markets that were created all over Moro province. They were designed specifically to provide well-regulated, open, free trade sites where the Moros, regardless of rank, regardless of ethno-linguistic identity, regardless of location, could bring whatever they wanted to market and could sell it in a very free trade kind of atmosphere. And the Americans, once they began to implement these policies, found that the Moros responded incredibly enthusiastically and began to bring all kinds of things. Production increased. They were beginning to engage in handicraft and agricultural pursuits and all kinds of things, and began to participate in these markets. And so this got the Americans very excited, and they said, okay, well, now what we need to do is we need to introduce them into the world of emerging technology. And so they held agricultural fairs and conventions and public lectures and a variety, introduced new technologies and metalwork and animal husbandry and fertilizer and a variety of things to enhance their production. The Americans were also one of the aspects of capitalism that they liked the best was the competitiveness of it. Now, the Americans were firm believers in this sort of competitive synthesis, that innovation and production is the result of competition for prizes, you know, whether that prize be profit or recognition or whatever. And so one of the things I found most interesting that the Americans tried to implement was the concept of the old county fair, right, where you could bring livestock, you could show your livestock, you could receive prizes from the livestock, you could sell the livestock. They promoted baseball teams. They promoted any kind of competitive atmosphere. And what really elated the Americans was that the Moros were willing and happy participants, that they didn't have to sort of coerce them into doing this and explain it to them and change their culture. The Americans found that the Moros intuitively grasped all this, that they were eager participants, that they took this in new directions, and the Moro markets very soon were being run by Moros and regulated by Moros. And the American military felt that this is it. This will lead to everything. This will lead to an equaling out of the class system. It'll eventually lead to the institutions of civil society. This is the key to their evolution. And so really, the main tutelary thrust of American military colonialism in Mindanao was to create this capitalist ethic, this competitive ethic that they felt would essentially solve all other problems on their way to sort of technical modernity and to the world of the modern.
Now, there's a whole lot more to the book, which we won't be able to get to. But one thing I did want to ask you about was in the epilogue, you talk about modern Moreau identity. Mm-hmm. So can you give us a little bit a perspective on how this history is viewed by Filipino Muslims today?
Yeah, well, this is always the temptation with a book like this. And one of the things that I wanted to try to avoid that I don't want my book to do is a lot of times books on the Southern Philippines are written as sort of strict teleologies of the current circumstances of Moros in relation to the Philippine state. So in other words, okay, here's a conflict. The conflict is kind of edgy. It's current. So let's run out and explain it backwards. And I really didn't want this book to do that in any way. Nevertheless, it is difficult to write a book on the history of the Moros and not include some of the very urgent contemporary matters. And so what I tried to do in the epilogue is I tried to frame it in the sense of the ideological sort of identity roots, I think, that play a part in some of the current conflicts. And that really is that the Moros, I think deep down, are very offended by the nationalist project and its constructions of an authentic nationality. So I think that a lot of times throughout the history, particularly post-war, there's been this sense among the Philippine state and among some decision makers and perhaps the population at large when they look at the Moros and they're sort of asking, why don't you just get with the program, right? Why don't you just get with the program of the nation state? We're all Filipinos now. Why the separatism, right? Why this urge to remain so distinctly and fiercely independent? And I think from a moral perspective, the point I tried to raise is that the Moros sort of gasp at this concept of national authenticity and say, what are you talking about? We are the original Filipinos, right? I mean, we are the only ones that haven't been conquered repeatedly. So the Spanish came and there was sort of a mass conversion to Catholicism. The Americans came and there was sort of a mass conversion to American patterns of consumption and popular culture. And, you know, the old saying goes that 330 years in a convent, 50 years in Hollywood, you know, that kind of thing. And even under American rule, which we assented to at least in – or we, you know, conceded in a certain sense, we made every effort to retain our original identity. And the – we didn't have time to talk about it, but the Americans never really eradicate moral servitude. They never really eradicate polygamy. They never eradicate Islam. And so I think in some ways the Moros are saying we're the authentic ones, okay? Even our national hero, Lapu-Lapu, is – Muslim, you know, and that's disputed in various places. But you keep wanting us to be part of this nationalist project when we are the originals, right? We are the authentic ones. And so in some ways, I think the Filipino Muslims, the Moros felt very, very betrayed in 1914 when American military rule ended and Moro province was folded over into the Philippine colony at large and was folded over into civilian government. And the Moros felt that this is the beginning of the end. I mean, we're going to be overrun, which subsequently turned out to be true. We're going to be overrun by a Filipino Christian majority. We're going to be marginalized, ancestral lands taken away, all which of course has happened. And in that sense, we're under constant threat of annihilation. And so even up until the 1940s, there are prominent datus among the Moros that are writing these passionate letters to FDR saying, please, you know, keep us separate. Figure out some way in which we can administer our own affairs. Please keep us out of the Philippine majority at large. And let us continue in our sort of don't want to put words in their mouth, but in our sort of authentic ways, right? And so the conflict today, I think in many ways, echoes the Moros' ascent into this modern project of the nation state that under the American military, they seem to remember very fondly. You know, I say that with some, you know, major caveats. There were some incredibly violent engagements. I published a piece on Badajoz, which was a massacre of Muslims in an extinct volcano, and some very sharp conflicts. But I think when they look back, they say, look, the American military, you know, where we may have had troubles, at the very least, sort of respected the Moroness, right? That they looked at our culture, they looked at our civilization, they looked even at our bodies, and they said, look, there's something here worth preserving. There is something here that is compatible with modernity, something that should be preserved, something that should be encouraged. And I think that once they were turned over to the colony in 1914 and subsequently to the project of the nation state in the Philippines, that they feel that that same respect has not been extended, that that same idea of the distinctness and the potential of the Moro hasn't been perpetuated under those circumstances. And, you know, I think in some ways, at least at an ideological level, is still at the heart of a lot of the difficulties that are occurring with various attempts at autonomy and separatism and efforts to reclaim ancestral land and migration and plebiscites and, you know, the whole history of it. That in some ways, this notion of the authenticity that it was allowed to flourish, that was recognized under the American military, is something that they haven't seen since.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure speaking to you about your book. I hope people will go out and get it because I think it will benefit a lot of people in Islamic studies and beyond. Before I let you go, though, I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit more about some of these really interesting projects you're working on, things you might have coming out soon, or things you're thinking about more long term.
Yeah, definitely. I've gotten really interested in the whole concept of colonial exposition, right? So all of this knowledge that I've been looking at in terms of how the Americans constructed Moros and how they're creating identities and handling disruptors in the narrative and these kinds of things, I found fascinating. But I'm also interested in, I guess, classic new imperial fashion on the ways that these ideas in the periphery are having a deep influence on the metropole. And so this idea of colonial exposition has really caught my interest. I just submitted an article that looked at the first display of Filipinos in the United States, which, interestingly enough, occurred in Omaha in 1899 at the Greater America Exposition. Hmm. And the piece looks at the ways that Filipinos are encountered. But in 1899, it's so fresh, it's so new that the Americans don't really have any ideas. They don't have a discourse to draw upon. And so when they look at the Filipinos, they don't really find them exotic or strange. They just kind of look at them and say, huh, they're neat. And they don't there's no major knowledge breakthrough. There's no, you know, and it's interesting because when you contrast that with what happens later in 1904, there is a very firm discourse in place, not only for Filipinos, but, you know, getting even into the micro where they look at the Igorot headhunting dog eaters, which were the sensation of the 1904 World's Fair. And the next book project that I'm currently working on is the Moro experience in 1904. And the Moros very much are presented in the ways that the Americans and the Moros collaboratively had constructed themselves in the province as being sort of these frontiersmen, being violent, but also being very, very honorable in their violence. But it's interesting because the Americans considered the Moro experience at the fair to be a failure. They were really disappointed with gate receipts and with the way the Americans perceived them, and they felt that the public had missed out on an opportunity to see the real potential of tutelary colonialism, and they were only interested in sort of the sensational aspects of the Igorots. And so the project's exploring why the Americans were so disappointed, but this one's – I feel that I'm able to actually – get a little bit more of the subaltern voice, actually. There's quite a bit of actual moral voice that I'm coming across in this 1904 World's Fair. And so it's interesting to see how they view the Metropole, how they view this as an opportunity to present themselves and pursue their own particular interests. And so I'm really excited about it as it's going forward.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Perhaps we can talk again when that comes out.
Oh, I would love it. I would love to.
Well, thanks again, Mike. And again, it was a pleasure. You wrote a great book.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was my conversation with Michael Hawkins about his great new book, Making Moros, Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippines Muslim South, published with Northern Illinois University Press in 2012. Thanks for all your support and listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. We'll